just a moment. Under Castro, Cuba kicked much ass before the Soviet Union tried. They had a sweet military. It was, I'm not sure exactly where in the military of the world it ranked, but they were definitely going around the globe kicking ass, that goal of being one of the places. Cuban military power has been sharply reduced by the loss of Soviet subsidies. Drastically. Really don't have much military anymore. The lack of dueling resulted in reduced training and military exercises, because even the military they do have isn't getting properly trained. Today, the Revolutionary Armed Forces number about 50,000 regular troops. That's what they've got. And which means the civil war that occurred in Cuba would still be a terrible, bloody conflict, but if we decided to go take them over, it wouldn't be much of a battle. Let's talk about their economy for just a moment. Yes, we know it's socialist. Under the slogan "Socialism or Death," the Cuban government continues to proclaim Cuba as a socialist or communist nation, with an economy organized under Marxist-Leninist principles. In 1997, in 1993, this is probably important, the Cuban government made it legal for people to possess and use the U.S. dollar. They shouldn't send the dollars to the major currency. In fact, many businesses won't accept pesos anymore. They only accept U.S. dollars. My point with this comment and the comments earlier about them doing things like free enterprise zones is that despite their still claiming under the rubric of socialism, it's just capitalism in drag. It's just, you know, it's free market without admitting you're doing any sort of free market principle. And you see a lot of countries doing that. And according to the propaganda of our government, Cuba's failure to launch serious economic reforms led to the development of a large black market and growing corruption. I say the reason that that's occurred is because we are choking them. We're choking them economically. It's not that they're failing to engage in reforms that might solve. Most places we've tried to do large-scale capitalist neoliberal type reform, we've done nothing but screw over the impoverished in that country, screwed over the labor, destroy the environment. Okay? So I don't think it's necessarily the fault of lack of reforms, those problems are occurring. I think it's the fact that we've got our hands tightened strongly around their neck. Let's talk about foreign relations with Cuba really quick. They once had an ambitious foreign policy. Like I said, they were all over Latin America. They were up in Angola. Not so more. They don't have the cash to do it anymore. Economic hardship has really put them in a bind, and they need to focus domestically all the time. Cuba aims to find new sources of trade and foreign investment and promote opposition to U.S. policy, according to the U.S., especially the trade embargo and the 1997 Libertad Act, that is also known as the Helms-Burton Act. For those of you who don't know, we'll talk about that in just a moment. Let's talk about U.S.-Cuban relations for just a moment. I'm just going to go down to some dates. January 7th, 1959, we recognize Cuba as a new government. All right, Cuba, you're recognized. What did we turn around in June 1960? We sanctioned the hell out of them. The U.S. began sanctioning what they perceived to be a Soviet satellite for many minutes. I think the better reason why we probably started sanctioning them is that when Castro took power, he appropriated or nationalized, whatever you want to say, all U.S. holdings in that country that largely angered U.S. business interests. And that's one of the reasons that the Congress fought so hard to put those sanctions in place. It wasn't just the anti-communist bloc, it was the pro-business bloc that wanted those sanctions in place. Now, those blocs are regretting. Let's talk about the tightening of the embargo. This began in the 1990s, okay? During the 70s, okay, well, rather, in 1962, I didn't mention that, I'm sorry, I never bold faced. February 3rd, 1962, the U.S. government imposed the total embargo of U.S. trade with Cuba, except for food and medicine, which was non-subsidized by the U.S. Okay? Now, since the 1970s, we tried to engage them. There's backlash in Congress. It doesn't work. So we abandoned Reagan. What do you think Reagan does? Well, of course, he's going to be an ass. He just tries to tighten it down even more. 1990 is when really a lot of the key changes have occurred in U.S.-Cuban policy. October 1992, what happened? What legislation passed? What? Yes, Torricelli, the Cuban Democracy Act. It did a few things. It codified the embargo into law. The embargo had never been codified into law, which is why all of your plans, if you're running Cuba, necessarily overturn the CDA. It also provided for measures of support to the Cuban people and for improved telecommunications with Cuba and some sales of medicine. Don't be fooled, okay? We only did those small concessions because they were politically palatable to the Cuban-American community. Oh, I'm sorry, the right-wing faction of the Cuban-American community who's been dictating Cuban policy for some time. May 1993, H.R. 2229 is introduced into Congress by Representative Rangel. It is crushed. It does not pass. Why? Because it is a bill called, it's basically called the Free Trade with Cuba bill. It wants to lift all sanctions. It's immediately crushed. February 1996. Have you noticed that we decided February is a good month to jack up Cuba? Seems every time we decide to take it to it, we do it in February. I don't know why. But we believe that in February of 1996, we decided, in our infinite wisdom, that the Cuban government has moved aggressively against 140 groups of pro-democracy and human rights activists who were seeking to hold a meeting under the auspices of the umbrella organization. And I know I'm terrible at my Spanish, so Concilio Cubano. Okay, yeah, I don't know. Now, on February 24th, 1996, the day that meeting was to be held, the Cuban government ordered the this is our version of it, that the Cuban government ordered the shoot down of two unarmed civilian aircraft in international airspace. Three U.S. citizens and one legal permanent resident, all members of Miami-based textile organizations, rose to the rescue, were killed when the plane was shot down by Cuban MiGs. Well, any reforms that were in line were shot after that. Clinton immediately retaliated. He ordered five punitive measures in response to the shootdown. He suspended all direct charter flights to Cuba, and he sought to obtain international condemnation of Cuba's actions. He also began pushing extremely hard for Congress to pass what would become a very, very familiar name to you. That is the Cuban Liberty and Democratic Solidarity Act, better known as the Helms-Burton Bill, okay? Now, like I said, the embargo was codified by the CDA. What the Helms-Burton did, well, there's four parts to Helms-Burton. I'll just tell them to you. First, Title I codified and tightened enforcement of existing embargo, okay? The second thing it did, it states U.S. policy toward the transition of democratic government in Cuba. It specifically spelled out what our goal is in Cuba. Next, it created a cause of action in U.S. courts. Those of you who haven't been to law school, cause of action just means grounds upon which you can bring a claim in a court. So it authorized a cause of action for U.S. nationals with claims of confiscated property in Cuba to file suits in U.S. courts against persons trafficking in that property. Okay, but like I said earlier, one of the reasons we got pissed at them was because they appropriated all of our business land, business holdings in Cuba, right? Nationalized it for the country. We don't like that. That's what Helms-Burton does. The last thing Helms-Burton does, which is the real reason that all of our allies are up in arms about Helms-Burton, is it extends the sanctions to third-party countries. Okay, it finally codified that France, if you trade with Cuba, we're sanctioning you. Britain, if you trade with Cuba, we're sanctioning you. This is not sitting well with our allies. They are going to the WTO and they are complaining that we are losing credibility back. If any of you are going to write a Cuba case, advantage one might be WTO credibility. I mean, that'd be an awesome story. The cards are really good. That's what Helms-Burton said. Now, let's fast forward 1998. We started to see less need to them for some reason. I'm not sure. I guess it wasn't February at the moment, so we're kind of being nice. This is where your uniqueness problems for Clinton come in. March 20th, 1998, Clinton announced measures intended to respond to visits of the Pope. He resumed direct humanitarian charters. He reinstated legal remittances for Cuban Americans and Cuban families living in the United States. He simplified and expedited the issuances of license for the sale of medicines. And he also said he worked with Congress to develop bipartisan legislation on the transfer of food and expansion of humanitarian assistance. Now, while he had to live up to all of those, he had been easing sanctions. They were allowing some food and medical supplies to get through to Cuba right now. The problem is, they've structured it in such a way, and the reason it's politically palatable to the people who normally oppose these sanctions is because other sanctions that are in place are making it almost impossible to get that food and medicine there. That's why it's politically palatable. So when someone reads Marx saying, we're looking at sanctions now, laugh at them, saying, yeah, we're looking at sanctions now, whatever. Read a card saying that makes any bit of a difference in Cuba. It doesn't exist. Most of the cards say, this is not near enough. We've got to look a bit farther. So, that's what I have to say about Cuba. I think that went a little long, but to be honest, this is the case you will hear more than anything else on the topic. If you are not ready for Cuba when you go to a tournament, you will lose rounds. Mark my words. First thing you should do is make sure you get your Cuba hits together. That's Cuba. Let's talk about Syria now. I was never really sure about Syria, but I really have a lot of love for the Syrian people now. It sounds like they're pretty sweet. The official name of Syria is the Syrian Arab Republic. Okay? It's called Syria, obviously. I will go through the demographics. You've got those as well. The government, it's a republic. It's under the Arab Socialist Ba'ath Party regime. It has been since March of 1963. They gained their independence, I believe in France, on April 17, 1946. Yes, Arab countries also have constitutions. We are not the only horseshit souls in the universe to have a constitution, of course. They have one as well, and it was written in 1973. They also have three branches of government, just like us. Legislative, judicial, and executive. Yeah, that's the other one. They also have political parties. A lot of people don't know this. They have the Arab Socialist Resurrection, that's the Ba'ath Party, which is in power. The Syrian Arab Socialist Party. The Arab Socialist Union. The Syrian Communist Party. The Arab Socialist Union Movement, and the Democratic Socialist Union Party. And don't think that those aren't important, okay? Political process did that about Syria, those are going to be important, yeah.
Can you repeat them one more time?
Yeah, sure. Arab Socialist, just Ba'ath Party, B-A-A-T-H. The Syrian Arab Socialist Party. The Arab Socialist Union. The Syrian Communist Party. Don't get many votes. The Arab Socialist Unionist Movement and the Democratic Socialist Union Party. If anyone didn't get those, get them somewhere else, just see me afterwards. Last one was the Democratic Socialist Union Party. Their economy. They got a lot of natural resources, crude oil, natural gas. Again, they can't sell a bunch of it. Because we're sanctioning. Let me real quick preface. Tomorrow we're lifting a bunch of sanctions against Syria. And I have a feeling that before the topic starts, all sanctions and the embargo in its entirety will be lifted against Syria. So I'm not going to spend too much time here. But I'll talk about that in a moment. It's just my guess. I don't know. Trade. We'll talk about the trade for a moment. They have a lot of it. Their exports are $3.4 million. Things like petroleum, textiles, phosphates, roots, vegetables, cotton, things like that. Their major market are the former Russian states, former Soviet Union states, Eastern Europe, EU, other Arab countries, notice not the United States. They also import. They import more than they export. They import $4.1 billion from a lot of the same countries. But we send them stuff. We import stuff. We export stuff to them. We still buy any of their stuff. Let's go. History of the government really quick, and I'll try and rush through this. Let me skip forward to 61. 1961, following a military coup on September 28th, Syria seceded from the union it had with Egypt. It reestablished itself as the Syrian Arab Republic, which it is today. March 8th, 1963, the installation by leftist Syrian officers of the National Council of the Revolutionary Command, the NCRC, the transitional government for a while. February 23rd, 1966, a group of army officers carried out a successful intra-party coup. They imprisoned President Hafiz. They dissolved the cabinet and the NCR, and they abrogated the provisional constitution that designated a regional civilian Ba'ath government. 67, Syria and Egypt got their ass seriously whooped by Israel, which weakened the radicalist socialist regime established by that 1966 coup. Conflict developed between the moderate military wing and the more extremist civilian wing of the Ba'ath Party. The 1977 retreat of Syrian forces sent to aid the PLO during the Black September hostilities with Jordan kind of reflects political disagreement within the ruling Ba'ath leadership. This is when Assad, who is the president now, Hafiz al-Assad, he effected a bloodless military coup, ousting the civilian party leadership, and he still remains in power today. He's been in power for some time. He did a couple good things. He really went and quit, and he did things like supported the peasants, and he supported the farmers, and he also brought stability to a country that had not been stable for a hell of a long time, and that's why he's still in power today, because they kind of like him. So I'll skip all that about Assad. National security issues. President Assad is commander-in-chief of the Syrian armed forces. They comprise about 400,000 troops, which is not shoddy whatsoever for any army. And there's a substantial number of reservists in addition to that. The breakup of the Soviet Union, long their principal source of training, material, and credit. Notice there's a trend here, like countries we sanction used to get aid from the Soviet Union, but don't anymore. There's kind of a little something going on there. I just think it's a good stuff. The break of the Soviet Union, the principal source of training material credited against the Syrian forces, they forced Syria to find other military suppliers. Right? Makes sense. Syria's recent years purchased from Slovakia, Russia, Bulgaria, Scuds from North Korea. They received significant financial aid from the Gulf Arab states as a result of its participation in the Gulf War, with a sizable portion of these funds earmarked for military spending. Besides sustaining conventional forces, Syria sought to improve its unconventional weapons capability. By expanding missile force, Syria continues to develop its chemical weapons capability, according to our government. I got that from the State Department. Okay, so they don't say very good things about Syria. Political conditions in Syria. Again, it is ruled by an authoritarian regime, okay, which exhibits the form of a democratic system, but where Assad wields almost absolute power. His government has held power longer than any other since independence. In fact, in 1992, he began his seventh term, which is longer than most leaders around today except for Castro. Again, I told you why he survived for so long. The Syrians were sick and tired of political instability, and he appeased to the right factions, right? Peasants, farmers, and religious groups who had lost a long time and persecuted by the previous regime. Let's see, going to talk about that. Get down. Let's talk about the economy really quick. I mean, basically, you know, it's an authoritarian government with a political situation run by the mass party. And they're ensured to rule by the Constitution. Economy. Syria is a middle-income developing country. It's not a diversified economy, although we've been doing our best to completely screw up, as you all well know. It's based on agriculture, industry, and an expanding energy sector. During the 60s, society and state ideology had governed nationalized most major enterprises. They haven't really done a lot to develop their capital markets, which is one of the reasons they're not breaking into international financing, which I don't necessarily think is a bad thing at all, but according to our government, it's a terrible thing to get involved with global finance these days. About two decades of heavy military spending and expansion of the public sector, Syria accumulated a huge external debt, which they still owe to many people. That might be actually in your demographic, how much they owe. They've also they've also had a lot of loans out by the IMF. And they're all accompanied with austerity measures. And I don't know if y'all know what austerity measures are or structural adjustment. Anyone heard of this stuff? It's akin to genocide, really. It's the most evil thing propagated on Earth. They're economic policies that we give countries. They're economic policies we force countries to implement in exchange for our hard-earned dollars. We make them do things like destroy their environment, destroy their labor, slash social spending, and cut wages, and give rich people a lot of money and tax cuts, and it's just a ridiculous economic policy, and that's what we're doing in Syria. So the IMF is doing in Syria. Let's see, foreign relations real quick. Ensuring national security and increasing influence among its Arab neighbors and achieving a comprehensive Arab-Israeli peace settlement, which includes the return of the Golan Heights, are supposedly the primary goals of President Assad's foreign policy. Okay, which means that's got implications for when we talk about Israel, right? Because this says that their primary goal is getting the Golan Heights back. Now, there's cards out there saying it's not necessarily, but if that's true, you probably got some little arguments going on about Israel there. Now, let's see. This is actually important. Syria's involvement in multinational coalitions during the Gulf War and their participation in the peace process have really helped improve their relations with the West, which kind of leads me again to what's going on right now. Back in April, we decided to lift almost all sanctions against Iran, Syria, Libya, and Sudan. That goes into effect tomorrow. Okay? Tomorrow, we're lifting sanctions on Syria. We're not lifting all sanctions. We're lifting a hell of a lot of them. One of the reasons is we're kind of happy. We also think there are real big markets we want to get into. So tomorrow, we'll be lifting sanctions. But again, like I said, I got a good feeling that by the end of the summer, the embargo on Syria in its entirety will be lifted. So I would not advise you jumping on a Syria case at this point. So let's move on from that. Syria is extremely interesting, but I think we should talk about probably Iran next. All right, everyone got everything so far? Yeah, with me? Everyone? They're going to be brought in. I'm sorry about that. We'll make sure you get one before the end. I'm sorry about that. Any questions so far, briefly? Anything you admit? I went too fast on probably so. Okay, there's the end if you want. We'll move on to Iran now. This is a country that is going to be a major change in the topic. Again, like I said, not like Syria, where you're probably going to have much play. Iran's going to be a serious topic. And it's got good uniqueness answers, right, to the affirmative, because in addition to lifting a lot of sanctions in Syria, we're lifting a lot of sanctions in Iran tomorrow as well. I'd really get a newspaper tomorrow if you're in the vicinity, or maybe you jump on the internet and check out CNN or something and see what they have to say. The official name of Iran is the Islamic Republic of Iran. Makes sense. Most people know that. Their government type is an Islamic Republic. They again also have a constitution. Isn't it amazing how all these countries who aren't supposedly as sweet as we are also have constitutions? They also have three branches of government. Imagine that. A country besides the United States with three branches. I'll never get over that. Let's see. Economy. Iran does pretty good. They've got a lot of natural resources. What's their biggest natural resource?
Oil.
Oil, yes. You will get to know the Iranian oil debate very well on this topic, is my assumption. They also do pretty good in agriculture. Wheat, rice, other grains, sugar, beets, fruits, nuts, corn, all sorts of stuff. They grow over there. Their industries, again, petroleum, petrochemicals, textiles, cement, and then they have a lot of lower ones, clothing material, food processing, but oil refining, number one over there. Trade. They export about 18 million. They import about 28 million. I'm sorry, billion. Those were billions, not millions. No, that would be a lot. That's kind of what their economy looks like. Society briefly. Well, the 1979 Islamic Revolution occurred, and the war with Iraq transformed Iran's class structure politically, socially, and economically. Before then, they were really a tool of the United States. Okay? And that's why we got so freaked out, right? When they overthrew the Shah, we're like, oh, come on, we'll give you asylum. What happened in 1979 besides that? Don't remember? Well, y'all might have been around now. I was a little kid. Sorry for the hostage crisis. What did you just say? You saw me old. Damn. I was young when that happened. Yes, the hostage crisis happened. And despite the fact I could barely read, then I knew that was going on. What happened was they held their hostages for about a year because we gave the Shah asylum. A year, and we got embarrassed during that. Like you said, Delta Force, supposedly fighting force in the world. They get a black helicopter. They go to Iran. What happened? They get halfway to Tehran. They get sand in their engines. They crash the desert, and they take the service and die. That was our rescue attempt. What happened was, Carter lost the election in 1980 to Reagan. And really, one of the main reasons I believe that they gave up the hostages in 1980 was to make Carter look bad. They never got along with Carter. They really didn't like him because he was responsible for, again, helping out Shah, opposing their new regime, things like that. So they released him. I guess either make Carter look good or Carter look bad, Reagan look good, who knows. But they released the hostages in 1980. That was the hostage crisis, prime time. Clerics dominate politics in nearly all aspects of Iranian life. Although you'll read some arts, they become a little more westernized. Still, predominantly like controlled by religion, right? It's an Islamic Republic. The Ayatollah, the Khomeini, runs the country, right? 4 years away, the Ayatollah Khomeini. Okay. Unemployment. It was a major problem before the revolution. It's got a ton of costs. It's just as bad now. But their economy's not in great shape. Definitely some argument ground here. Most Iranians are Muslims. 95% belong to the Shi branch of Muslims. That's the official state religion. And about 4% belong to the Sunni branch. History, well, it used to be called Persia. I'll leave it at that. That's the history of Iran. no, that's not true. I will start in 1961 and tell you a few things. So in 1961, Iran initiated a series of economic, social, and administrative reforms that became known as the Shah's White Revolution. Okay? The core of this program is land reform. Modernization and economic growth proceeded at an unprecedented rate. Fueled by Iran's vast petroleum reserves, the third largest in the world. Now what happened was, though, in 1961, 1979, they were making all these sweet reforms, their economy cruising and all this, but it's just getting screwed over this entire time. It's the peasants and the poor and the minority who exist in Iran who are paying the price for these things. Right, I was talking about earlier, big external macroeconomic reform. Well, that's what the Shah implemented, and that's one of the reasons it's so unpopular. That's one of the reasons it was so easy for them to take over. 1978. So this goes on to 1978, right? The economy's going great, but really the people who matter in the country, the non-elites, are really not feeling any of it. In fact, things are the worst they've ever been for them. So 1978, domestic turmoil swept the country as a result of religious and political opposition to the Shah's rules and his program, especially Islamic. Okay, I think it's Sovic. Sovic was the Internal Security and Intelligence Service. And when they showed up at your door, you had to talk, you had a tendency to disappear and never show back up again, all right? They're kind of like the KGB of Iran kind of thing. People didn't like them too much, and that was one of the reasons they really wanted to out the Shah, because they didn't like getting kidnapped and murdered in the middle of the night. I can't imagine why, but you know, they didn't appreciate that. So in 1979, Shah left Iran. We said, oh, Shah, we'd love to come, we'll take care of you. That's when Iran really got mad at us, and he died abroad 7 years later. Again, February 1979, the Ayatollah Khomeini returned from France when he'd been in exile, and to direct a revolution, resulting in the new theocratic republic guided by Islamic principles. We've kind of been there for a while. Remember, we all hated Iran back in the 80s and early 90s. Then we decided, no, we hate Iraq, so we better like Iran, right? The whole policy, it's nuts, I don't understand it. The policy is supposed to be a policy of doom and pain, where if one of us freaking out, we help the other to combat it, right? But it just seems like, I don't know, whoever's pissing us off the most at the moment, side with the other one. So right now, I guess we're kind of friends with Iran, because we hate Iraq so much. That's what we're just expecting to them, right? It's not that all of a sudden they adopted all these principles of human rights that we hold. No, that's not it at all. We just need an ally in the region, right? We need somewhere to launch our attacks from, I suppose, somewhere to put our bombs together at. We talked about the government a little bit. We talked about the political conditions in Iran. So about let's just jump to U.S.-Iranian relations. I think this is the most important aspect of this. U.S.-Iranian relations. November 4th, 1979, we know what happened again. They occupied the American embassy in Tehran, right? We were supposedly radical students who did this. 52 Americans were held hostage for 444 days during this. On April 17, 1980, the U.N. United States broke diplomatic relations with Iran officially. On April 24th, 1981, the Swiss government assumed representation of the U.S. interest in Tehran. Iranian interests in the United States are now represented by the Pakistani government. In accordance with the Algiers Declaration of January 1981, the Iranian-U.S. Space Tribunal, located in The Hague, in Netherlands, I was just there, by the way, was established for the purpose of family claims of U.S. nationals against Iran and of Iranian nationals against the United States. U.S. contact with Iran in The Hague covers only legal matters. Commercial relations between Iran and the United States is mainly of Iranian purchases of food and manufactured products. The U.S. government prohibits the export of military and dual-use items to Iran, as well as items forbidden under anti-terrorist legislation. Right? Remember, they're on the terrorist list, that's all the rest of the countries, because we decide they're terrorists, right? Because they go around killing people. Sounds like another country I can think of. Right? It's not on the top. Let's see, where did it evolve? There are serious obstacles to improved relations between the two countries. You have to find 5 areas of objectionable Iranian behavior, although we're kind of turning a blind eye today, right? Because tomorrow we're looking at the sanctions. First, their efforts to acquire nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction, right? We complain about this about everyone, right? Oh no, you're a brown person. You possibly couldn't understand how to use a nuclear weapon. You better not have them. Right? We're the only ones who have nuclear weapons. So we don't like it when they get nuclear weapons. Its involvement supposedly in international terrorism also kind of irks us. Its support for violent opposition to the Arab-Israeli peace process, all that's been changing a little bit. Its threats and subversive activities against its neighbor, and its dismal human rights record. Again, this is from the Department of State homepage. The U.S. believes that normal relations are impossible until Iran's behavior changed. However, the United States has offered to enter into dialogue with authorized representatives of the Iranian government with preconditions. We've changed this stance, right? The more we hate Iraq, the more we like Iran. So right now, we've decided to lift the sanctions on Iran, which will happen tomorrow. That's Iran. Let's move on to Iraq.